Okay, so I'm here with Lynn Tillman, who is most recently the author of Someday This Will Be Funny. Lynn, it's a pleasure to chat. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well. I'm happy that I was finally able to title a book Someday This Will Be Funny.
Yes.
And if you've noticed, there's no story called Someday This Will Be Funny.
Exactly.
In the book. So
it's literally a grab bag for the reader. They can determine if it's funny or if it's not funny, or if it will be funny tomorrow or 6 years from now.
Or never.
Never. So, irony, it seems. I wanted to, first of all, start from an unusual tack. In Brandon Stosi's Up Is Up, But So Is Down, you bring up an interview with Lou Reed and William S. Burroughs where they're talking about Kerouac. And Reed says that he can't understand how such a great writer was a slob. This is an anecdote you bring up. You're just fascinated by this, that he just drinks beer in front of the TV. And then, you know, Burroughs responds, well, Kerouac did that when he was young, and he just grew up to be an old slob.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting pretext to talk about, well, what do you have to give up to be a writer, to stay fresh as a writer? I mean, it's said that you often have to stay young. Then there's the Flaubert maxim, be calm and orderly in your life so you can be violent and original in your work. So I must ask you, Lynn, in light of the fact that you've struck such a variegated crop here yet again, what you had to give up and what have you not given up? I mean, how adult are you?
Oh, I'm just a child. Totally immature. Give up. Well, I had to give up making a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, it was never in my legend anyway. I never really thought about it. Only as you get older do you realize that you made a choice in life that is not financially wise.
Yeah.
But what do I give up? I don't think very much, because this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I guess I give up a certain kind of calm or sanity, because trying to write your next story or find your next book, your next novel, what you want to do, can be extremely difficult and painful, and there's no reassurance in it. I guess I've given up reassurance.
Yeah.
In a way. When I worked as a proofreader, 1 week on, 1 week off, actually at Forbes magazine.
The ultimate soul-sucking atmosphere.
Ultimate. I knew that where I would be for 12 hours a day for 5 days. And it had its own, in its tedium, it had its kind of calming effect.
Yeah.
And sort of in that time, I didn't have to think about anything. I just had to be a good proofreader, which wasn't that hard for me.
Yeah.
But when you're writing, there are no assurances.
Yeah.
So if I've given up anything, it's the sense that I can feel satisfied.
Yes.
Because as any writer will say to you, it's always the next book you're worried about.
Yes. You may be giving up assurances, but on the other hand, you're getting liberty in return. You're getting freedom. I think the question I had was whether there is some lingering adolescent quality that you're holding on to, or is it really just this idea of getting used to the idea that there is no assurance, that in its own way is also creatively liberating, even if you have no specific timetable for when your next story or when your next novel is going to come out of you?
Well, I don't know that those two ideas are entwined with each other.
Yeah.
I haven't given up my childhood in the sense that it's still a source of material for
yeah.
me. Not that I write autobiographically particularly, but that whatever the desire was that made me want to be a writer from a very early age, it's still there.
Yes.
It must still be there, because I keep going.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to actually bring up Dear Ollie, because a person named Lynn Tillman is the author of that letter.
Right.
What's also interesting is I know that that appeared in 2002 in McSweeney's, although that's not actually named in the book.
Yes. It isn't?
No, it's the one credit that's missing. I can
is
show
it
you.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, well, show me later.
I didn't know if you were trying to hide the origins so
no,
we could actually...
No, I wasn't.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's a mistake.
I mentioned this because you recently did an interview with Lydia Davis
yes.
in the Electronic Book Review.
Yes.
And you said, by the time I use something autobiographical, it's not about me and my life, and we were just discussing your discussion of autobiography triggered this. Does this mean that you're dispensing with emotional investment when you use something autobiographical? Are you, in the case of, say, Dear Ollie, approaching the autobiographical form from an entirely new emotional vantage point?
Well, I don't know if it would be new to me, in the sense that I'm working out of stuff that happened. In this case, it had to have happened. Paul Malyshevsky edited this section, and we all had to put our last name. We had to use our real names, as far as I recall. And that's why the name is included. It's the only time I've ever done that.
Oh, really?
As if the writer and the author, that the narrator and the author are the same.
As if you were a friendly witness. Yeah.
That's exactly. Or unfriendly.
Yeah, exactly.
Ambivalent, anyway. That was not difficult material to write about. It wasn't terribly emotional for me.
There was an Ollie?
There was an Ollie, and there was a prank. It had to be, Paul wanted a real prank. And I thought, well, this was a prank I participated in. Wonderful, practical, horrible joke.
Yeah. Well, this explains a lot, because when I read that, it just kind of sticks out like, wait a minute, why is there this absolute need to correct the public record? Because I think of your work, and I think, I don't think she's the type of person who needs to do this, but since you were actually asked to do so, this makes complete sense.
Oh, it's completely invented. Yeah. The writer in there.
Okay, got it.
That's the invention.
Okay.
I used the device of writing. It had to be a letter.
Yes.
And I used the device of writing to someone who had also been in this situation, and who then went on to become a writer.
Yes.
And his characterization of this event, I objected to. And of course, Lynn Tillman, who's writing this, objected to. There was an Ollie, the musician.
Yeah.
There was no writer.
Well, I'm curious about this idea of autobiography. I mean, when you're mining from it after you've experienced it, after you've thought about it, what dregs are left generally? I mean, is there anything left to mine? Are there incidents that are the basis almost for two separate stories sometimes?
Well, it's not drained of feeling, all feeling, but you're able to see in an incident that you yourself experienced with more distance a way that it has pertinence for other readers. In other words, it's not so close to me anymore that I can't give it up, so to speak, and it exceeds my own personal history.
Yes.
For instance, in American Genius, a comedy, The Death of Cats. One time I read a story that's not in here, an older story called Boots and Remorse, to an audience, and I had more audience reaction because it was about a cat that had gone crazy.
Yeah.
And tried to attack me. This was an essay. It was in the broad picture. I'm remembering it now. And because so many people related to this experience of an animal in their home and their relationship to the animal.
Yeah.
When I was years later writing American Genius, a comedy, I thought, oh, this is material I can use. Now, it's not that I'm completely separate from that material. The pain of an animal being put to death or whatever happened to that will always be with me, but I also recognized that it was not just my material. It was material that was porous or other people could fill in themselves.
It's often said that readers are going to react more emotionally if an animal is hurt more so than a fictional character sometimes.
Oh, I think that's true.
Yeah. I wanted to also talk about, since we're talking about American Genius, the essay-like narrative trajectory of that book. It's echoed in a few stories in this, That's How Wrong My Love Is, and also Impressions of an Artist with Haiku. You've mentioned in other interviews that one of the editors who rejected American Genius told you, I don't know what Lin is trying to teach me. Now, at the risk of reductionism, is one of the key things that separates, say, your essay-like fiction from, I suppose, true blue nonfiction essays, this pedagogical requirement? Why do you think this perspective-based thrust kind of carries this teaching exigency?
Well, first of all, that editor, in rejecting it, I think exposed her bias.
Yeah.
She would not have written that to a male author.
Yeah.
It's really about our writers who are women allowed to play with ideas in the way that the way that male writers, Nicholson, Baker, yeah, for instance, can a woman do that? So it was when I got that, when my agent showed that to me.
Yeah.
I just thought it was disgusting, frankly. No one else has reacted.
Yeah.
Like that.
But do you think that that's not just the fact that you're a woman, but also that that book is narrated by Helen, who's a very neurotic woman?
Yeah.
Even though, as you point out, Nicholson Baker can write about neurotic males who also have their similar obsessions.
Well, what about Moby Dick?
Yeah, yes. The glorious clam chowder chapter in there. I know.
Yes, and all the information about whaling.
Was it just this editor, or have you experienced other people singling you out because your fiction does tend to gravitate towards the minutiae in life?
Well, it's not just the minutiae, I think.
The connections.
General,
yeah.
In general,
yeah.
Ideas,
yeah.
You know, and I think that has been pointed out, my sometimes cerebral or intellectual or so on. But for me, I'm trying to marry intellect and emotion. I don't see the separation. If a theorist is writing about something, whatever it is, however abstruse, they're writing it also because they're emotionally attached to the issue in some way. There's a reason why they chose to write this rather than that.
How many of these ideas tend to come from perspective? I mean, you're talking about very esoteric ideas at times coming from this deep emotional place. Where's the starting point? And I have actually a follow-up in relation to this, but I wanted to just for sort of get kind of a germination idea, not necessarily where do you get your ideas or how are you triggered by these ideas?
Well, with American Genius, a comedy, I was triggered by the concept of sensitivity.
Yeah.
And so there we are in, you know, the 2000, early 2000 and 2001, 2002, George Bush makes a preemptive strike, first preemptive war, apparently, except I think the Spanish-American War was preemptive war. But
yeah.
And all around me, people are talking about sensitivity, whether it's to the food they eat or to the atmosphere, and I was thinking, isn't this strange? We've all in America become so sensitive.
Yeah.
There's so much going on about that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we just elected a president who went immediately to war almost as soon as he could. I'm not saying that everybody supported Bush, but it's a kind of ethos that was very contradictory to me, so that was the initial idea, and then Skin came from that, and Skin has always been a subject I'm interested in, because it shows so much about people, and in an unconscious way, blushing or people get psoriasis or all sorts of things happen with the skin.
When you phrase it this way, the thesaurus in your mind would immediately go from sensitive to thin-skinned in one instant, and then voila, there's the book.
Yeah.
Is that what happened?
Well, it's not that was part of it,
yeah,
the starting point. And then getting her voice was another. And placing her in a situation far away from the usual, isolating her in a community in which I could also discuss ideas about democracy, which is part of what goes on in that community. And then I had to find a structure. And the structure, I thought, well, in any institution, you have to be given 3 meals a day, whether you're in prison or college or a sanitarium or an art colony. You get 3 meals a day, and I thought, that's it, that's my structure. And as soon as I had my structure, I just went wild with it.
In light of how pronoun happy that book is, and in fact many of the stories in this book, I'm curious if you knew...
How do you mean pronoun happy?
The reluctance to name first names in both American Genius. At the end, we later on learned that it's Helen, previous book, of course. And similarly in the stories in this book, what is interesting is that in most cases it's she, but it did actually lead me to want to ask you about later.
I think there are 5 stories in that are from the have a male protagonist.
Yeah.
In this, yeah.
Yeah.
And my new novel is going to be a male protagonist.
Oh, interesting. Cool.
Yeah.
But the reluctance to name names, combined with the first name familiarity of Later, which features Marvin Gaye and John Lennon, along with Give Us Some Dirt, which features Clarence Thomas. I'm curious about first name basis with these celebrities or these notable figures versus no names at all in these stories except for someone telling their story and maybe naming a few other people. Why keep the cards close to your chest on this topic? I'm curious.
Sometimes I guess it seems strange to me to name a character because it's a kind of sudden, it feels artificial intrusion into the sentence.
Yeah.
In American Genius, a comedy, my plan was to have her named 2/3 of the way in when it would make sense that her name, she would see her name. Not that, I mean, such an introspective novel in the first 2/3. Why would she be saying using her own? I mean, it just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, if we're rambling to ourselves, why do we need to name ourselves?
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
And I could have had one of the other characters in the place, the institution, name her, but she was having such fun making up names for people.
Yeah.
Like the disconsolate woman or the tall balding man or Contessa and, the Count and Spike and all of that. So I really enjoyed doing that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to give her a regular name, till the end.
Common nouns are filled with more possibility for you than proper nouns or even pronouns, proper nouns, proper names?
I mean, a proper name is so... we have so many attitudes toward it already. In my first novel, Haunted Houses, I used very plain names, Jane, Emily, Grace.
Yes.
So I wanted names that didn't have associations like a name like Tiffany would have now, or Ashley, or, calling your child Sky or something like that.
Or Joaquin, or River.
Yes, that's right. Or Beyonce, or something like that. I just wanted it to be plain. I didn't want the reader to make all sorts of associations.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. Now, in one of the stories, Shadow of a Doubt, he's named Thomas. And I think in other stories I do... But I choose names that are very sturdy, I think.
Yeah. You don't want the reader to get so caught up in the name that they'll lose their way of accessing this introspection.
That's right.
Yeah.
And or to make a determination about who that character is based on the name.
Yeah.
Because obviously families are have reasons for naming their children what they do. And... then it does have associations, and it's hard to rid the name of the association.
Yes.
But I felt with American Genius Comedy that by toward the end, the reader had earned it to know her name, and yet I'm sure many people thought, Helen, that's not the name I felt about her, you know, felt for her.
This leads me into a segue. I read the Observer piece with you, and the reporter for that story, to go ahead and go with the running theme here about names, he said she reacted as if he had said incest when he had mentioned backstory.
Right.
In light of what you just said about the reader earning the right to know the name, which makes complete sense because we are, after all, strangers often when we're reading books, you know, and this apparent resistance towards backstory, I have to ask, I mean, you know, you were saying like, oh, I can't stand it when a student says, I need to know more about that character. Is this sort of in line with, like, say, Hemingway's iceberg theory? Or is this, I mean, obviously the writer should probably know their characters fairly well. It's a matter of how much you share them to the reader. So what of this?
Well, they're two. It's not that I don't think characters can be developed or
yes.
should be in certain instances. What happens with students often is when they're reading things in manuscript and they become interested, and then they think, well, if I just knew more, people, it's as if people want an answer to something, but it might not be a question in the story.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're asking things that you don't ask for in stories that are already published.
Yeah.
That ambiguousness, if it's called for, if it's appropriate in the story, is perfect.
Yeah.
And there is a mystery to why human beings do what they do.
Yeah.
You can't motive them to death. You know what I mean? You
yeah.
can't. There aren't absolutely discernible motives every time someone does something or why they do it. There are unconscious
yeah.
reasons. And the other thing, too, is I object to the term backstory.
Yes.
It's a Hollywood term. And it doesn't
theater
have...
Too.
What?
Acting in theater.
Yes.
It's, I mean, you know, you're not a fan of theater either?
No, I am a fan of
yeah.
theater. I like
or
movies.
Method acting.
whatever works.
Yeah.
But it's just bringing that into fiction, that kind of concept, to me, I think trivializes the process of writing. I just... Maybe it's a great handle for some people writing fiction. For
yeah.
me, I need more backstory. It just sounds like, you know, 12 people in a room smoking cigars, and where's the backstory? Something like that.
But if they say, I need to know more about that character...
Then I'd want to know why.
I see. Okay. So, I mean, this is interesting because if it's a matter of semantics... To what degree do you object to, say, film and theater crossing into fiction? Do you think this has been a real pox upon 20th and 21st century contemporary fiction?
No, I think that we've learned a lot. I've learned a lot from film editing. I used to make films. But they are different mediums, and they can do different things. For instance, you can create interiority in a novel in a way that it's very hard to do in film.
Yeah.
You know, somebody like Antonioni, I think, did it as well as anybody.
La Ventura. You don't yeah. know where the woman went halfway through the movie.
That's
you,
right.
You never know. So.
No, and you're looking often at architectural spaces.
Yeah.
And Edith Wharton does that in her novels.
Yes.
She uses architecture to indicate people's positions in life and feelings about the positions they're in, yeah.
You had mentioned this conversational idea of you cute interfering in much of the emerging writers and the like. And in getting at some of the problems you see in contemporary fiction, we were talking about ambiguity, we were talking about readers earning the trust to know the name, earning the right to know the name. I mean, it seems to me that you're asking for the reader almost to do more work, to have a bigger stake in earning the incentive. Is that safe to say? Or?
I want the reader to be engaged and
yeah.
to find pleasure. And I think sometimes things get spelled out for readers that really don't have to be spelled out.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what do we read for? And it's a very big question. In Cast in Doubt, my third novel, which was written from the point of view of a gay man in his mid-60s, that was one of the questions on my mind. You know, what was Horace, that was his name, looking for when he got Helen's, I brought her name back for American Genius of Comedy, when he found and sort of stole Helen's diary.
Yeah.
What was he looking for? And in part, he was looking for himself in that. He couldn't find himself there and was very distressed, you know. And it's not that we read... I read many things with which I don't identify, but I can find my desire somehow in, and not just sexual desire, but desire to think, desire to be mystified, desire to learn, desire to be distracted. You know, I can find things in the spaces in a book.
Yes. Well, this leads me to ask you about a few of the stories in here approach sex and relationships from very interesting vantage points. In More Sex, we meet a woman who wishes to transgress the statistic that men think about sex every 7 minutes, and she goes ahead and sets up an egg timer, and every 7 minutes, like clockwork, thinks about sex. In The Substitute, there's a similar effort to get off the straightforward when you have Rex and the woman described as intrigued dogs sniffing each other's tempting genitals and asses. I think it's safe to say that pretty much none of your stories take anything less than the oblique approach. I'm wondering if you have made any efforts to, say, tackle a subject such as sex or another idea from a very direct angle. Was this largely in the early work?
How would you mean direct?
Just basically, instead of sniffing like dogs, just saying they had sex or something.
My first longish work was called Weird Fucks.
Yes.
And it was...
You got all the fucks out of your system.
Well, that would be an interesting idea, actually. Some of them I wish I could. But they're 13 chapters, interrelated, and so they're short stories, but it's also like a novella, I think. And in each of them, she has sex with a different man. And I've never been able to write, I've not been able to write sex the way Edmund White can.
Yeah.
I mean, he's amazing at writing sex. I think he probably has the greatest sexual imagination of any writer I've ever read. I mean, the Marquis de Sade is something else. But he can articulate movements and feelings, and whether he's actually remembering these things or just making it up, I don't care. It's beautiful. It's amazing. Yeah. I really don't think... I don't have that capacity.
Yeah.
Maybe at some point I will try to have that capacity. I'll try to work for it.
You're more comfortable with the oblique, introspective approach to the many aspects of our world rather than just gesture. Gesture has been something that has been kind of... you're still working on even today, or...?
Gesture?
Yeah, like gesture or movement or things along the lines of the Edmund White, you know, school that you were describing earlier.
Well, not exactly sure what you mean. I still watch people.
Yeah.
And I'm still interested in how their bodies carry meaning. I guess American Genius, a comedy, was my most bodily written work.
Would have to be, yeah.
Yes, the most involved with the body as such. And that was deliberate.
Yeah.
I wanted to try to do that. In each of my novels, at least, and in the stories, I try to do something I haven't done before. More to challenge myself and just see if I can do it. You know.
I wanted to talk about the apothematic moments in your stories. which gets at some.
Oh,
of the...
I just thought of something.
Oh, yeah.
And one of, and I think it was in Motion Sickness, but there's a line somewhere that I wrote, which I've remembered. Most of my lines I haven't.
Yeah.
And, which is about the tongue is privileged with information that I can't remember the rest of. But that idea of the sensual, the being in some sense beyond words.
Yes.
That's why somebody like Ed or Dennis Cooper, you know, who can kind of nail certain kinds of feelings, you know, that they in their different ways are intriguing to me.
Got it. Yeah. I wanted to also touch upon the apothematic quality in your stories. I mean, you have, for example, in Come and Go, not contained in this, when you fall out of love with a narcissist, life is emptier. In the original Impulse, people often move away from cities and towns when reminiscences create profound debt and mortgage the future. Even in the shadow of a doubt, you have the morning dove chirping, the biggest lies are the ones you tell yourself. Now, why do these seemingly pithy summations, which obviously sound close to many Hallmark cards I've seen.
Oh my God, I hope not.
What I mean to say is that they're interesting observations, but they're not necessarily going to be the absolute Band-Aid or cure-all for the complicated emotional situations that you're
depicting. They're not supposed to
be.
Yeah. They're not. Well, I think the last one you mentioned is supposed to be a kind of a fantasy fairy tale. So
yes.
I think the other two are more unusual than the biggest lie, you know, is the ones you tell yourself. That's a deliberate kind of use of a cliche.
Got it.
But the other two are not cliches. I guess I enjoy philosophy. I enjoy thinking about how we live our lives, and I'm trying to figure out how to write those from a character's point of view.
Do these serve almost as little positions with which to wiggle the introspective narrative, you know, and kind of shake away from some of these apothegms?
I don't know, really. I think that they may be holding points where where a reader might stop and think about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Rather than moving on. I don't want, since I'm not a plot-driven writer, although it's also true that I do work with plots in a less obvious way in some of my stories. You need to have things that keep the reader engaged.
The incentives. Yeah.
So maybe a pithy little statement is an incentive to go on.
So it seems to me that many of these serve almost in lieu of a straight kind of plot. Yeah.
Perhaps. Yeah. That may be the case.
In But There's a Family Resemblance, you have your cultural protagonist remark, shame is different from 30 years ago, it doesn't last as long, speaking on this topic. To take this one step further, do you think that this ephemeral shame is responsible for what I was trying to get at earlier, the you cute conversational style in contemporary fiction? You mentioned that you had seen a lot of this in the 2009 interview with The Millions. That's what I was hoping to get about. Is shame necessary for fiction? Or?
Oh, everything's necessary for fiction.
Reader shame, perhaps.
Yeah. I was thinking about the way shame and guilt have framed a lot of American fiction. In fact, I forget who it was. There was a critic, was it Leslie Fiedler?
Yes.
Who said that guilt shaped the American novel, and, you know, certainly you could make the case for Hawthorne and for Melville and, you know, in loads of ways. But, I don't think anything is responsible for anything else. I think our world is way too complicated and complex, and with there's so many different things going on every moment, you know. But obviously, everything is affecting everything else in ways that we don't know. We just don't know. But if you're going to write about a character feeling ashamed, you probably won't think of that character in the year 2011.
Yeah.
You might be thinking more even 1980 or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not that people don't still feel shame, they do, but it's what we seem to be being pushed toward is more and more the idea of openness. And the idea of openness is now conceived to be, in part, telling everybody everything. Now, I don't necessarily think that is what it's cracked up to be, because you can say something about yourself that about which you're completely dense yourself, and you don't even know what you're saying. And so what are you actually being open about? You're saying something, but it's not revelatory to you. Remember, the only people who are shocked by things are the people who do the thing. I mean, usually, in rare instances, is anyone shocked by anybody else. You're mostly shocked, let's say as a writer, you're mostly shocked by what you've written. I never thought I could write about that, the kind of thing. And the shock of other people is unimportant.
Yeah. Or the shock of repetition, that you should be wise enough to identify that mistake, or identify that false revelatory note, or identify, my God, I did it again, you know, even after decades of experience or whatnot.
Right. Yeah. Experience doesn't save you.
That seems a very beautiful note. Lynn, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting.
Thank you. Okay. It was wonderful talking to you, too.